This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Once just a radio show, but podcast listeners like you are part of the fastest growing segment of our audience. So thanks for downloading what you might call the Pocket Takeaway. Here's our daily show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. There will be oil.
There's a whole ocean of oil under our feet. No one can get at it except for me.
I want American oil from American soil. Oh, when I think about all we import, you know it makes my red blood boil.
Yes, the last decade has seen a worry about the insecurity of fossil fuel supplies around the world, rising and then falling prices for oil, and then, as that song suggests, a domestic oil boom, fueled literally by our belief that American oil from American soil is the new patriotism.
One of the biggest factors in bringing more jobs back is our commitment to American energy. The all-the-above energy strategy I announced a few years ago is working, and today America is closer to energy independence than we have been in decades.
President Obama in his 2014 State of the Union address. That oil boom in the United States, tapping into tar sands and using new fracking technologies to get at the oil and gas trapped deep in the earth beneath shale deposits, has made the U.S. the rival of Russia and Saudi Arabia in energy production. An estimated 7 billion barrels of oil are sitting underneath the U.S. portion of the Bakken oil fields, 170 square miles stretching from North Dakota to Montana and into Canada, with high-paying jobs for workers all along the way. But a new investigation finds that those high-paying jobs also have high risks. In the first comprehensive analysis of its kind, reporters at Reveal, that's from the Center for Investigative Reporting, found that on average, a worker dies about every 6 weeks from an accident in the Bakken. That's at least 74 deaths in the oil fields since 2006. Jennifer Gollin is a reporter with Reveal. She says that the top energy firms are taking advantage of limited oversight in North Dakota to push workplace safety beyond the breaking point.
We obtained a document from a top official at Oasis, a drilling engineer, and this was 4 months before the well blew up in September 2011. So 4 months before this well exploded, which killed two workers and injured two others, the supervisor on this well was congratulated for working quickly, for setting a new drilling record. And she went on to call this record-holding well the quote-unquote pace setter. Again, looking at Oasis's record in particular, they often pay performance bonuses of $150 per day for drilling quickly, compared with $40 a day for drilling safely.
So let's describe then how vulnerable the people were who were involved in this particular accident that you looked at in September of 2011.
So the circumstances related to this actual well were that it had been fracked and drilled. And this particular crew, there was a crew of four men, and they were brought on site on this day in September 2011 to get the well to produce more. And the day before they arrived for this work, the company man, the supervisor on the site who was representing Oasis, apparently put down thousands of gallons of salt water into this well to control for this gas, to apparently make it safe for these men to get the well to produce more the next day. Unfortunately, the well exploded.
And tell me a little bit about Jebediah Jesse Stanfill, who used to work in the oil fields, who witnessed this accident, and what is it about this accident that he can't get out of his mind?
Jebediah Jesse Stanfill, he often goes by Jesse, was working on an oil rig less than a mile away. He was near the top of the rig when he heard this boom, and he spun around, grabbed a fire extinguisher, a first aid kit, and jumped in this truck with two coworkers. Two men died as a result of this accident, and two men were injured. And as Jesse was helping to pick up some of these men to load them into the bed of this pickup truck to drive them to the ambulance, some of the men's skin came off in his hands. And that is a feeling that to this day he just can't shake. He wears gloves most of the time when he's playing with his kids or even when he's in his kitchen or gardening, And it's really to protect him from feeling the memory of those men's skin on his hands.
How can a simple thing like looking at your hands or washing your hands send you completely enveloped back to that day? Like the scenery changes. It's as if I'm there. It rules my life.
He certainly sounds emotionally devastated even now from the accident. What kind of workers were on that rig, and what is it that drives these workers?
As far as the men who died that day, there was Brendan Wegner. He was just 21. It was his first day on a rig. He was scrambling down the derrick ladder when the well exploded. It consumed him in this fiery tornado of oil and petroleum vapors. Rescuers later found his body pinned under a heap of this twisted metal, and his charred hands were recovered later, still gripping the derrick ladder. And then there was Ray Hardy. He died the next day from his burns. And a third man, Michael Twin, who was injured, had to have his lower legs amputated, and he committed suicide 2 years later. And there was just one lone survivor who was burned over half of his body.
Did Jesse and the injured workers and the fatalities that occurred at this accident, do they fall into the cracks of federal regulation? Are they in any sense casualties of violation of regulations or the result of an absence of regulations entirely?
OSHA regulators will tell you that they often have to rely on a part of the law called the General Duty Clause. And basically, it means that it makes it very difficult for them to hold top energy producers accountable because they typically don't have direct employees on these well sites. So as a result, in many of these cases, the top energy producers are not fined, and it's the subcontractor, typically the company that employs these workers, that gets fined.
Now, many of the states that are in the same situation as North Dakota, producing huge amounts of oil and gas through fracking and the new drilling technology, Texas, Louisiana, New Mexico, and Wyoming, they've started to pass laws that might prevent oil companies from shifting liability onto their contractors. That would force the big oil companies to actually take the rap when there is an accident of this kind. That's not the case in North Dakota. What's going on there?
In North Dakota in 2011, the state legislature considered a bill that would have prevented oil and gas companies from forcing their contractors to sign agreements that shifted their liability to them. There are these four other large energy producing states, Texas, Louisiana, New Mexico, and Wyoming, that have passed laws to either restrict or limit how oil companies use these protections in their contracts. But in the end, heavy lobbying from the oil industry torpedoed this bill, and it was never passed.
Is OASIS happy with the state of affairs right now? Are they fighting to get these regulations rolled back? What's their response to everything that you've discovered here?
OASIS has told us that safety is tantamount at their company and that they would never put workers in jeopardy.
Jennifer Gollin is a reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, looking into worker and workplace tactics in the Bakken oil field in the middle of a oil and gas boom in the United States. Thanks so much, Jennifer.
Thank you so much, John.
Efforts have been made in other states to regulate the working environment in the modern oil field, where explosive forces of compressed water and chemicals have caused double-digit increases in the death rate among workers. Wyoming is one of those states. Jack Bedesim is the past president and advisor to the board of the Wyoming Oil and Gas Industry Safety Alliance. He's also the president and CEO of the Trihydro Corporation, an environmental and engineering firm. He joins me now. Jack, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
And describe for me what Wyoming has done to prevent some of the circumstances that were described in that last report.
Wyoming has historically also been a state that has experienced a high number of workplace injuries and fatalities. In 2009, Governor Friedenthal commissioned a workplace fatality prevention task force to study ways and develop recommendations to reduce and prevent injuries and fatalities. That task force came away with several recommendations, one of those recommendations being to establish industry safety alliances that would assist the industry itself with improving the safety culture throughout the industry.
Would you say that the regulation process now is rewriting a situation for the fracking era? Are we dealing with a regulatory environment that's still in many ways rooted in the there will be blood period of the 1800s?
I don't believe so. With respect to the Wyoming industry, Oil and Gas Industry Safety Alliance that I'm associated with, we've assisted the Wyoming OSHA on several occasions since the Oil and Gas Industry Safety Alliance was formed in 2010, with actually helping them update their regulations in many cases to meet industry standards that are used across the oil and gas industry.
How dangerous is this trade-off alluded to before of pushing production as fast as possible and as deep as possible and keeping workers safe?
I'm sure that culture is out there amongst some companies. The members that we have with the Oil and Gas Industry Safety Alliance are very, very safety conscious companies.
And what is it about the fracking workplace itself that people might not realize are serious safety issues? The forces that are used underground are not well known.
That is correct. The primary goal that we are trying to accomplish with our organization and our alliance is to provide training to the industry, to employees, large firms and small firms, to ensure that they understand and are utilizing the best practices to keep their employees safe.
Do people need an education to work on these work sites, or is it pretty much elbow grease and hard physical labor?
It's a combination of both, but certainly anybody working on these rig sites needs a certain level of education. Most of the members of the Wyoming Oil and Gas Industry Safety Alliance have very stringent requirements for educating their employees and their subcontractors with respect to proper safety practices before ever showing up on site. And in many cases, those requirements are more stringent than the regulations.
The issue of safety on American soil, where there's tremendous efforts to get American oil out of the ground under the Bakken oil fields. Jack Podesum is past president and advisor to the board of the Wyoming Oil and Gas Industry Safety Alliance. He's also president and CEO of the Tri-Hydro Corporation, an environmental and engineering firm. Jack, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
So many people could do so much better if we fixed a few things.
Part of a family that has committed its life to public service.
The message will be a hopeful, optimistic one. We'll talk about why it's important to change directions.
I want to be authentic and genuine. I'm going to be who I am. I'm not going to change who I am.
I have to show what's in my heart. I have to show that I care about people, about their future. It can't be about the past.
And as usual, the present administration is supporting the use of coercive federal power.
Knowing what we know now, would you have authorized the invasion?
I would have, and so would have Hillary Clinton.
I'm very proud to be the son of George Bush.
And my brother, well, I love my brother.
If we share our enthusiasm and love for our country and belief in our philosophy, we will be able to get Latinos and young people and other people that you need to win to get 50.
Mr. Testing the Waters becomes official presidential candidate Jeb Bush today with something close to $100 million in his bank account and a bunch of confused statements on immigration and the Iraq War for voters to mull over. Once the would-be GOP bridge builder and centrist juggernaut who would keep other people from entering the race, thought he would have it to himself. Now Jeb Bush isn't even the only candidate from Florida. He enters the race with Florida Senator Marco Rubio already in, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, and former Texas Governor Rick Perry already in the field, along with Rand Paul, Lindsey Graham, Carly Fiorina, and Rick Santorum, among many others. John O'Connor, political reporter for WLRN in Miami, now on the Jeb Bush game plan. That seems to be well into Plan B right now. John O'Connor, what is Plan B, or are we Plan C already?
Well, Plan B, they had the big campaign shakeup last week. They brought in a new campaign manager to run things that was a little bit unexpected. But what we'll see, I think, is the original plan from Jeb, which is to run on his record. He's got 8 years as an executive, is Florida's governor. He has a long record as an advocate, particularly for education and other issues since he left office. And I think those are the things that we're going to hear from him today.
Some of the statements from Jeb Bush in the past suggest that he wants to violate the formula here, the primary GOP primary formula, where you steer right and then go center in the general election. Do you think he can do that? And having the race to himself certainly made that much easier, but that's not going to be the case now.
It will be a difficult path. If we look at national polling over the last few months, his trend is downward, particularly among voters expected to vote in the Republican primary. And so the guy that we thought was going to be the 800-pound gorilla several months ago now looks a little bit weaker. He doesn't look quite as strong despite the money, despite the political network, despite the name. And so it looks like it may be a difficult path to try and run through the primary while having your eye on a general election campaign the entire time.
Can big funders keep him afloat in the era of Citizens United?
Absolutely. It only takes one. We've seen a lot of candidates who have lasted a long time in the primary system with only having one big funder, and he has many big funders. He obviously, the family, the political connections, the long history means that he will be well funded, and you know that is an advantage. At times, it looked like folks were going to sneak up on Mitt Romney the last time around, and because of the money, because of the funding, he was able to outlast all that. Jeb Bush should have some of the same advantages.
So let's talk about Florida for a moment. I mean, Marco Rubio's already in the race. Is the vote split there in Florida? And then widen it out, if you could.
Well, Bush and Rubio, Bush was a mentor for Rubio. And so they have some of the same political connections. So there is a little bit of a divide, particularly Miami. But folks who have been in the Bush camp remain in the Bush camp. And the folks who were most loyal to Rubio are kind of still most loyal to Rubio. So I don't think that long term that those things are really going to be that big of a factor. Nationally, Bush has major advantages over a lot of other candidates just because the family political structure, two presidents within the family, the ability to raise money. His education foundations have had a national presence for years. And so he has a huge network to draw from.
What is this, the right to rise mission? It seems to be the message of the Bush campaign. It's the PAC that his funding comes under. Obviously, it's slightly independent from the Jeb Bush campaign. But nevertheless, what is this right to rise message?
Well, it's been mocked somewhat by some of the other folks who are thinking about running, but it's a fairly traditional, optimistic Republican message that through hard work, through personal achievement, that things can get done, and the PAC is going to be the major kind of voice for the Bush message, because they'll be able to bring in the big money and put out the message.
And that's where much of the estimated $100 million is, although they may not meet that goal by the end of June. That was one of the reports I saw today. So then let's end on atmospherics. Can he maintain this embrace my dad and brother? I have a brother. Can that work? Really ignoring George W. and embracing his dad as a kind of a centrist and not really focusing on the record of his brother?
It does not seem to be working so far. Since late last year, the polling trends are that the family name is hurting him. And on the Democratic side, we have another legacy candidate, Hillary Clinton, whose husband was a former president. And it doesn't seem to be hurting her as much. But among Republican voters, having the Bush last name seems to be a liability.
Jeb Bush, officially in the race lots of questions right at the outset of his campaign. John O'Connor, political reporter for WLRN. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're asking you folks if you're ready for another Bush in the White House. Isabella's first reaction on Facebook was not positive. He's already proven himself a cheater. No thanks. You should give us some more details there about that, Isabella. At Hyde Park Media on Twitter says, per David Letterman, we need another Bush like we need another Kardashian. John Bates writes on Facebook, I think I'd rather exhume William Henry Harrison. Tough crowd out there in takeaway land, but we want you to keep the conversation going. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and you can tweet us at The Takeaway or comment at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Hungarian, hula hooping, and HTML. Curious.com, grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI. And LegalZoom, offering resources to help ensure the last wishes of individuals are upheld through last wills, living trusts, and powers of attorneys. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
The very glamorous, very visible Caitlyn Jenner story has changed the way many Americans think about the experience of being transgender.
I would like to work with this community to get this message out. They know a lot more than I know. I am not a spokesman for the community.
And that, in a way, is the message of this week's Retro Report. Caitlyn Jenner can't be a spokeswoman for the transgender community because her story is a wild distortion of the much more likely experience of being transgender. It's a story of fear, poverty, and isolation. Bonnie Bertram is a producer for Retro Report. Welcome back.
Hi, nice to see you.
So what was the mission of Retro Report? You normally look back farther in time than in this story. What did you want to do to contextualize the transgender movement in the era now of Caitlyn?
Right. Well, we started working on this in February, so it was well before the Caitlyn Jenner stuff had debuted and made such a big splash. And what was striking to us is that there was this whole forgotten history of this legacy of transgender activism and how they'd really been pushed to the margins of the history books. They played a pivotal role in Stonewall, which is remembered as the birthplace of the gay rights movement. But the transgender people's role is really something that's sort of been forgotten largely.
And here reminding us of that role is Professor Jennifer Finney Boylan from Barnard.
To be trans means to be visible. If you walk out your door, it can mean you are at risk for violence.
And is that today? Is that something that is associated
with... They are a resilient group of people because they face a staggering levels of suicide. They're often the targets of hate crime, and they're prone to live in extreme violence because in a lot of places, it's not against the law to discriminate them. So once you don't have access to resources, it starts this downward spiral that really imperils a lot of their lives.
And creates a social situation which is challenging, to say the least. Here's Lourdes Ashley Hunter, who's executive director of Trans Women of Color.
The community that I work for is wondering how they're going to eat tonight, wondering if they're going to have health coverage, wondering if they're even going to make it back to the shelter where they're staying. I don't want people to watch Transparent and say this is the lives of trans people, because it is not.
She's referencing there Transparent, which is certainly a groundbreaking program, but is at odds with her life.
Well, it's terrific, and no knock against all of those programs and all of the great visibility that's happening to transgender people right now. But what's often not told is the story that a lot of these people face, and particularly trans women of color.
And what is the reason for that? I mean, is it...
It's a hard story to tell, John. I mean, in a lot of ways, these people often are transient or homeless. So they live outside the parameters of traditional data-taking research tools. So you can't reach these people. So not a lot is known about them. The statistical studies that there are that talk about the way that they live and the obstacles that they face are not really 100% reliable. So it's a very sort of invisible group, which is ironic because to be trans, as Jenny says, is such a visible prospect.
And visible now because of the glamorous Caitlyn story. But here you allow Lourdes Ashley Hunter to tell a much different story that's not glamorous at all about her experience.
So I found myself homeless and end up having to be assigned to a men's shelter called Wards Island. Wards Island housed about 1,000 men. And every night, there was a fear for me. I couldn't sleep. I can remember a time where I went to take a shower, and a man came into a shower and raped me. And he had a razor blade. And there was nothing that I can do.
Lourdes Ashley Hunter, Executive Director of Trans Women of Color, speaking in your documentary on Retro Report. When is she speaking of? What years is she
speaking of? It happened in 2002, but this has been a problem, and it still happens, like the Ashley Diamond story in Georgia, that a lot of people who are transgender are put with people who aren't appropriate for the gender that they now identify with, which puts them in a bad situation, right? A homeless shelter or a prison. So they have, like, essentially a target on their back. And the fact that these people's humanity should be up for grabs at all, which is something that Jenny says so eloquently in our story, is really kind of shocking.
And at odds with the whole idea of everything's fine now that you get from the Caitlyn Jenner story.
Right. I mean, a lot of these people tell a much different story.
Bonnie Bertram, Retro Report producer, thanks so much.
Sure.
You can watch Retro Report's latest story on the transgender movement at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry, and I do try to reply to as many tweets as I can. Thanks for choosing us to listen to. Our motto is share what you know, and there are plenty of ways of doing that. Check us out. Take part in the show. There's more at thetakeaway.org. 800 years ago, this happened.
We want a council to represent rich people. We want a free church with a free steeple. We want you to stop stealing our sons and holding them hostage like you have done.
There's vital stuff here that you got to give us. There's also some stuff about fishing in the river.
Feels strange, but yes, it only took 800 years for the history of King John and the signing of Magna Carta to go from founding Declaration of Human Rights to a question on social studies quizzes to become a hip-hop track courtesy of the BBC right there. British Prime Minister David Cameron spoke with more gravitas today at the site of the actual signing of MC.
Magna Carta is something every person in Britain should be proud of. Its remaining copies may be faded, but its principles shine as brightly as ever. In every courtroom and every classroom, from palace to parliament to parish church, liberty, justice, democracy, the rule of law, we hold these things dear, and we should hold them even dearer for the fact that they took shape right here on the banks of the Thames.
And the person responsible for enforcing what some of those rule of law ideas became much later in the USA, U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch, also spoke from Runnymede, England.
Even today, America continues to pursue these goals. We are engaged in initiatives to promote trust and understanding.
Lynch and Cameron were joined by Queen Elizabeth II and scholars and dignitaries from around the world celebrating the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta. The document itself can be seen in the British Museum. Its relevance to today's notions of human rights are a matter for historians to debate. Tom McSweeney, assistant professor at William & Mary Law School, reminds us that Magna Carta was about some very local issues in England, not some universal declaration for future generations to embrace.
Well, it was designed to address issues that a lot of people had with the royal government in the early 13th century, particularly issues that the wealthiest landowners in England had against the king, the barons, the people who really held the largest plots of land. But there were other people who were angry at royal government, the bishops, the city of London. And Magna Carta is really kind of a miscellaneous list of grievances that various people in England had against arbitrary financial exactions, John's bad relationship with the English church, things like that.
And that's why in the send-up there from the BBC, there's a discussion of fishing in the Magna Carta, which relates to all these very specific details concerning land rights.
Absolutely. There are provisions in the charter that have to do with removing fish wares from the Thames and the Medway, so fish traps, basically, because the citizens of London were concerned about navigation up those rivers. But there are provisions about things like one of them says we shall have a uniform measure of wine throughout our kingdom. There's one on bridge building. That's one of my favorites. In the middle of a very technical series of chapters on the administration of the royal courts. There's a chapter that says no one will be constrained to build bridges unless they've been required to for a long time. And I just sort of imagine somebody ran into the room while they were discussing the royal courts and said, don't forget the bridges, you know, something like that. There are all these very specific provisions that we don't really read much about today.
Is it the case that the Magna Carta crystallized a sense of universal human rights that was already developing in the 13th century that King John kind of understood he had to agree with here? Or was this something fundamentally novel?
Well, there are a couple of different ways to think about that, actually, in the 13th century. On the one hand, Magna Carta is a very specific text. It's not about something universal. Charters of liberties were something that were fairly common in the early 13th century, and we should think about liberties. They're more like what we would call privileges today. So people were buying special exemptions from the law in charters of liberties. They were often purchased. And Magna Carta is sort of that. It's a series of special exemptions from the law. What's novel about it is that it's exemptions of the law from the general rule of law that apply to the entire kingdom. So that these things are, in a sense, posed in terms of exemptions from the law, but they're universal at the same time. So it is novel in that sense, that it's universalizing something that was before very specific.
And take us through the path of how some of these rights in the Magna Carta become inflated and underscored down through history to really connect with the liberties and the Bill of Rights that we understand today as being universal. How did it go from this very local event to something very global?
It's actually there's some very interesting historical developments there. I think one of the most interesting is the development of the idea that Magna Carta guarantees the trial by jury. So that chapter 39, the language by the lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land, has been read to guarantee the jury right. And in fact, language from Magna Carta and from statutes interpreting Magna Carta ended up in the U.S. Constitution when the jury right was written into the Bill of Rights. No one intended it to guarantee trial by jury in the 13th century. We know this partly because trial by jury wasn't the primary way of trying criminals in the early 13th century. It became the primary way of trying criminals by the 1220s, but it was because of another major event of 1215, the Fourth Lateran Council, which was an ecumenical council of the church, which met in Rome in 1215. And the Fourth Lateran Council was a very significant event, but one of the things it did was it said that clerics can't participate in trial by ordeal anymore. These are trials, or for instance, you dunk somebody in water to see if they sink or they float to determine their innocence or guilt. That was the primary way of trying criminals in England in 1215. And by the 1220s, because of the Fourth Lateran Council, the courts have switched over to using juries because they can't use ordeals anymore. No one thought it was because of Magna Carta. It's centuries later that people start to associate Magna Carta with the right to a criminal jury. William Penn is one of the big progenitors of this myth, the Quaker leader and founder of Pennsylvania. Quakers were very big on juries because they were being tried for illegal religious meetings. And they argued that juries had the right to acquit when they disagreed with the law. William Penn argued during one of his trials that Magna Carta guaranteed trial by jury and actually wrote language into the laws of Pennsylvania and New Jersey that mirrored Magna Carta when he wrote the jury right into their laws.
And made it into the U.S. Constitution. It's amazing to see the actual document there in the British Museum. How does it make you feel to look at it?
Well, it's always interesting to I love going over to the UK and looking at the original documents, knowing that, you know, a 13th century scribe wrote this out. Having that connection with a person in the 13th century is pretty neat.
Tom McSweeney, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All I do is hustle like Deli. I'm just trying to stay ready.
And here's something to take with you today. It's not exactly a protest song, but this hip-hop tune by Zebra Studios about Deli, Matthew Dellavedova of the Cleveland Cavaliers, is just one of the anthems from the NBA Finals. His own anthem notwithstanding, Dellavedova couldn't keep the Golden State Warriors from defeating the Cleveland Cavaliers in Game 5, 104-91. Now it's going to take a pair of wins and even more hustle from record-breaking LeBron James if Cleveland is to have a chance for the first championship in the Cavaliers' 45-year history. Game 6 is Tuesday in Cleveland, but if the fast-breaking Warriors win, it will be their first championship since 1975. That's all for today. If you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work, a great way to stay up on the news. And again, you can find us anywhere you get your podcast fix. Thanks so much for listening. Hustle Deli. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Yeah, I'm a hustle like Deli. Everybody in Orlando, I'm a beast already. City on my back, it's a feast already. Nose to the grind and I hustle like Deli. All day, I'm a hustle like Deli. All I do is hustle like Deli. I'm just trying to stay ready. Till I die, I'm a hustle like Deli. PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.